It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Illustrators get much of the credit for a successful comic book or graphic novel, and certainly the visuals are what separate those works from a standard novel or short story. But the story is the backbone of any novel, graphic or not, and Jim Krueger is a master at coming up with those stories. Krueger is a best-selling and award-winning author who grew up in New Berlin and graduated from Marquette. He worked in advertising here in Wisconsin before he made the move to L.A. to pursue his comic book dreams. His comic book writing includes the award-winning Earth-X trilogy for Marvel, as well as Avengers, X-Men, Star Wars, Matrix, and Batman. Jim Krueger was back in town in the spring and stopped by the Lake Effect studio to chat with Bonnie North about his craft and about how the role of the scriptwriter compares to that of the artist.
The difference is that the writer can probably finish a script a little quicker than the artist can finish a 22-page comic book in a given month. But for the writer, we can't just think about this issue. We have to think about the giant story, what 5 issues, 6 issues, 12 issues are all going to look like. So where an artist can kind of focus on 22 pages a month or something like that, we're really thinking about what's going to happen for the next year or two in a given series.
Right. The story arc has to be thought through.
Right.
And how do you work with the illustrators? Does the story come first in terms of written story as opposed to the illustrations, or are you working again pretty much in tandem there?
Well, it's a little bit of both. There's certainly a sense of being in tandem. And every artist I've worked with, I've talked about the story first. I've listened to who they are, what they like to draw, what really inspires them. A lot of times I'll write a script based on a particular artist style, and I'll be thinking about that even as I'm writing the script. But pretty much so you start with a script. And if it's a graphic novel, it has to be at least 88 pages long, which means if it's going to be in a Barnes & Noble or on Amazon or something like that, it has to be at least 110 pages for the spine on a Barnes & Noble shelf to work. So a lot of times you'll see a graphic novel that's 88 pages of story, and then there's an intro and there's a title page and there's some background sketches, and it just edges past that 110 pages.
How did you make the transition from advertising to comics?
I should probably start by saying that my dad, who was an auto mechanic and had a garage in New Berlin, Wisconsin, would, when I was 4, 5, 6 years old, come home with the sirens, you know, the lights spinning on top, and he would want me to go on the tow jobs with him. And so I would, and his payment for me for really doing nothing would always be a couple comics. So very much, you know, comics are kind of a rosebud for me. Very much there's a nostalgia that goes with it that's beyond just kind of the graphic storytelling. But pretty much so, the transition went like this. I was working in some small advertising agencies around Wisconsin, worked in Madison, worked in Sheboygan, and was doing okay. I was kind of in that junior copywriter job jump, which meant I would be 6 months one place, 6 months another place, won a couple Addy Awards. But you know what? I just wasn't meant for clearly kind of the agricultural products that I was doing. I mean, I was writing ads for Teat Dip, which is what you rub on the cow's udder. You know, I did this whole campaign because I researched, I spoke to a number of farmers, and they all said, you know, it doesn't matter, Teat Dip is Teat Dip. But yep. They all had great senses of humor. So I went for the humor. I went for, you know, this is the hands-down favorite, 4 out of 5 udders prefer, you know,
yes.
And all this sort of thing. And it just didn't really work out that well for me.
So Mad Men wasn't in your future in a literal sense.
At least not the Mad Men that are working on farms.
Right.
So, but
right.
But it was cool, and I met lots of really great people. And along the way, I sent my portfolio and a number of different things to Marvel Comics, and they responded by saying, "Yeah, we could use a copywriter to write ads for us." So I actually jumped, you know, and moved to Marvel within 3 months of kind of sending them a resume and started writing ads for them. So
it started in advertising, and then
yeah.
You moved over into stories.
Yeah. So when, you know, Captain America was going to take on Dr. Doom, there'd need to be an ad to promote it.
Okay.
And so that's what I did.
And then how long did you do that before you actually made the transition to writing scripts for the actual comics themselves?
I wrote ads for Marvel and worked my way up to creative director over 6 years, I think. And, you know, even in the midst of that time, I was working on other projects and had some outside comics happening and some different graphic novels happening. And I was beginning to be known as more than a copywriter. And not that I'm saying a copywriter isn't a great thing. I just wasn't a great copywriter, you know. But I had begun to really develop this other kind of sensibility, and I really wanted to go for it. And then Marvel went through its kind of terrible bloodletting days of bankruptcy and all that kind of thing. And in the midst of that, I did a project. I did some descriptions for this really famous comics creator named Alex Ross, this painter. And I wrote things on some sketches he did, and Marvel looked at it and said, oh, that's a real project. So, Jim, Alex, why don't you guys do this? And what was really interesting is that, you know, I mean, I think our entire department was wiped out on a given Friday. And the following Monday, I started writing Earth X.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really amazing. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking, well, you know, I'll kind of do both for 4 or 5 months, save up some money. And that just wasn't in the cards.
Right. But in a way, a good thing, because look at where you are.
Right. And, you know, clearly I always have to be pushed out of anything I do, because I'm totally a nester.
Well, as I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking about, you know, the comics I used to read as a kid, because I used to read, like so many of us, and I grew up in the 60s, and comics have grown up as well as those of us who were reading them then. And I think society tends to look at them much more seriously than they did when I was a kid. I mean, they were really kind of throwaway
right.
things, except for maybe a very few people. When did that shift happen, do you think, and why do you think it happened?
Well, I should probably say right now before I answer that question that mothers get a lot of grief for throwing out their kids' comics, so much so that it's that thing that gets said, oh, I would have thousands of dollars if my mom, I had Spider-Man number one, I had Fantastic Four number one, and she threw them out. But because of mothers, those comics are now worth money, the few that remain. Mothers, ironically, have created the pop culture kind of collectability of comics by throwing out all their kids' comics.
Right. So the very few whose mothers didn't are right. the ones who are lucky.
Yeah, but thank you, mothers everywhere.
Yes, for all kinds of things. But when did that shift happen? When mothers today probably aren't throwing out their kids' comics.
Right. I would say the shift probably began in the 60s with really the birth of Marvel Comics. Okay. It was really all that initial Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, the Hulk, X-Men, the birth of all those things really kind of made people look at these in a different way. And while those books weren't worth a lot, what happened is from the 60s to the 70s and then into the 80s, right around the early 80s, the specialist comic book retail shop, as opposed to just getting them at your local Century or whatever.
Which is what I did.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Or drugstore. What happened is when there became a specialty shop, all of a sudden you were able to go into the specialty shop and buy back issues, and you never knew there was anyone who even had back issues to sell. And so this kind of subculture grew. And at that time, comics would come out on Fridays, and so you'd see the same people coming in Friday, you know, having just cashed their check, you know, being willing to pay, you know, everything for it. And then as that happened, more and more special things and special event comics began to happen.
As you progress in this career and as all of these other things come into play, you know, the internet and movies and animation, as well as the books, the actual graphic novels, how do you see this medium evolving over time? I mean, you must be looking out ahead 5, 10, 15 years and saying, we might be going in this direction, whatever that direction might be.
Well, there's right now a plight. The guys who kind of wrote comics in the 60s and 70s are facing the fact that in so many cases, their properties have been turned into movies and they've seen nothing of it. Many of them are penniless. Many of them can't afford, you know, medical, and they're at the point where they have some very real medical needs. And so the lessons kind of we're taking, and there are groups that have kind of came out in response to that, and there are ways in which money is being raised to help them and recognize, you know, what they gave to the industry. But writers today in my situation are beginning to say, okay, if I create this and it's got any sort of worth to people, I need to continue being in ownership of it. And so it's much more, I'm creating a brand, I'm creating a property, and we look for publishers who will partner with us on those things more than just, you know, saying, oh, give me, you know, $100 a page and I'll write, you know, the next 20 issues of Fantastic Four.
Sure. It's almost like the old studio situation in Hollywood falling apart and people really having to negotiate their own contracts.
Right. Yeah. Right. And that's it exactly. And, you know, there's good things that come from that and there are bad things that come from that. You know, I mean, some comics are better and some comics are worse as a result of it. And, you know, there are lots of creators who are like, I'm going to take the dive. I'm going to do something creator-owned. And, you know, I'm going to forego getting a monthly check. And then the book comes out and it doesn't sell a lot of copies. And then the second issue comes out and doesn't sell a lot of copies. And the third issue sells, you know, less than half of what the second one did. And they're seeing no money from this. And now they're at month five when the graphic novel comes out, the collection comes out. And that makes a little. But all of a sudden, they're in a situation where they're like, oh, look what I did. Ooh, ooh.
Right. There is no safety net.
Yeah, there is no safety net. But I don't know. I think what's good, if there's something good about our current economy and the losses of jobs, it's that we all look at ourselves and say, there is no safety net. We have to create. We have to do things.
Well, Jim Krueger, it is such a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks.
New Berlin native Jim Krueger is an award-winning filmmaker, video game developer, and comic book writer. He's previously worked for DC, Marvel Comics, and Dark Horse, and is now president and publisher of his own comic book entertainment company called 26 Soldiers. The complete collection of his first project, Foot Soldiers, came out earlier this year. He spoke with Bonnie North in May.